Good morning, everybody. This is Lizzie and Justin. We are live on this beautiful Sunday morning from London. This is Turning Towards Life. It's episode 48 already, which is quite miraculous. I am in London, in central London. I'm just about to go to see Shakespeare's sonnets at the Globe in London. So I am on this beautiful embankment right by the River Thames. So I'm going to turn this computer, what do you call it, screen around so you can see. See if I can do the tech and just show you exactly where I am. This is where I am sitting, and it is absolutely beautiful day. There is a helicopter above, probably a radio station or something. And then this is where I'm going to be going later, which is the Globe. You can kind of see through there the Globe, and it's you know, people, very few people running around like it is normally not here in London. And it's a very gorgeous morning. So I am very happy to be here and very glad to be reading this wonderful source that Justin has brought. And want to really welcome you to this conversation. As usual, we are very, very happy to be here doing this. It is a beautiful, wonderful commitment that we're in. And this topic particularly, I think, is a wonderful one. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Me too. I'm as always, thrilled to be doing this. One of the things that we've started to bring into our conversation here, Lizzie, is how much this is a practice for us. We would be doing this. It turns out we would do this even if nobody showed up, but many people are showing up, and it's the intentional doing of a practice, being in relationship, I think, that makes this so powerful for us, let alone what it might be for anyone else. And maybe I'll read the source first, but before I do, I just want to say something about, it's the beginning of September, and at the beginning of October, the first and second, I think, of October, Lizzie and our very wonderful colleague Sue Braithwaite are going to be running our Introduction to Coaching program in London, Coaching to Excellence. And I just wanted to let everybody know about it, because if you've been in any way moved, or touched, or inspired, or had new questions opened for you by what we've been doing these last 48 weeks, this is a great opportunity to get together with a group of other people who are interested in learning, to be alongside Lizzie and Sue. And of course, this Turning Towards Life project comes out of everything we're doing in Third Space Coaching. It's not separate from it. So there's a huge possibility of stepping in deep, and we'd love to welcome you if you would like to come. So you can find out all the details for that on the thirdspacecoaching.com website. And now here is our source. So this is really the introduction to a very wonderful book by Christine Caldwell called Getting Our Bodies Back. And I'm going to say something very small about how come this source this week. I went to see on Thursday night a play in London called The Layman Trilogy, which is extraordinarily wonderful and charts the foundation, rise and fall of the Lehman Brothers Bank, which was right in the center of the financial crisis of 2008. And it's a warm, generous, beautiful telling of this story of humble beginnings and then big things that came from it, for good and for ill. And there's this extraordinary scene in the third act, right before the collapse of the banks, where the newly appointed director of marketing, which they've never had in a bank before, in the bank, is in the boardroom, and he's saying to everybody, I have this idea, and here's the idea. We will teach people that to buy is to be human. That buying is the path to human fulfillment and to human meaning. And we will redefine this word so that people understand that the more you buy, the better a person you are, which of course turns out to be very good for the banks because people borrow and all of that kind of stuff. And here's the thing which brought me back into this source, is it was very clear that what they were very deliberately trying to do was to have a story that would have us collectively go to sleep to ourselves, that we would stop being able to tell what nourished us, what was really nourishing to us, and instead would start to live in a way that was nourishing to them and would have us be in a sort of trance. It was really powerful. So I started thinking about all the ways in which I get into a trance myself and get out of contact with myself. And this book, which is so wonderful, came to mind. So I thought, I wanted to say all of that because this text looks like it's only about eating, and it is about eating, but it's not only about eating. It's about every way in which we lose ourselves. So here we go. Learning to Nourish Ourselves from Getting Our Bodies Back by Christine Caldwell. Some years ago, on a trip to the local mall, I bought a large cookie to share with my 4-year-old son. As we settled down to eat, my attention was drawn to him as he murmured contentedly, munched noisily, and consumed his half with delighted joy. I inhaled my half with obsessive greed, worrying about how fattening it was and wondering if anyone I knew was watching. The contrast in our experiences, given that it was the same cookie, shook me. I felt a stab in my heart as I realized that somewhere along the line, I had lost the happy relationship with cookies that he still had. The difference between us in that moment seemed to be that he was awake and alive while I was shut down and withdrawn. I vowed to myself from that moment on, I would let myself eat as much sugar as I wanted, but only when I could stay awake and truly celebrate the experience as much as my son had. What I subsequently discovered was that it was almost impossible for me to do this. At the first sweet bite, I would enter a state of oblivion, eat quickly and furtively, and then feel miserable. In short, I was not awake and alive, and this was not a pleasurable experience. It felt more like a driven experience with the same familiar outcome of self-absorption and self-hatred. As I stuck with my commitment to eat sugar only when I could remain present, I occasionally stayed conscious for a few seconds at a time as I nibbled, and I began to explore this awakeness. In those brief moments, I could see the cookie, I could luxuriate in its smell and texture, I could savor the taste and truly treasure it. I was actually having a rich sensory experience, albeit a fleeting one. I was amazed to realize that I derived immense pleasure more from the act of staying awake than from the actual eating of the cookie. Sensation was wonderful. And as I continued to stay awake, I found that I didn't really want much sugar. The experience of eating it while awake was so rich and full that a very small amount of it was all it took to satisfy me. I found myself eating much less and enjoying it much more. A little bit of something sweet once in a while was enough to occasion great happiness, and my body told me when to stop. This in itself, this feeling that my body was choosing, making a clear yes or no statement, was quite amazing. I hadn't expected my body to wake up as part of this process, and stumbling onto this result was astonishing. What I was discovering was the incredible power of self-regulation that is our birthright. This choosing power had been lost in the throes of the addiction. The benefits of my awakeness practice have been far-reaching. When I inhabit my body, I can self-regulate. I can also know when things like behaviors, relationships, and thought patterns are toxic, neutral, or nourishing. I have only to tune into myself to know, and from there, I must go on to the next, even more challenging step, that of tolerating and even welcoming the joy and health that result from actually being in my body and consistently choosing nourishment.
So, Justin, I'm going to make an executive decision to just read the last two paragraphs, because I think it's quite long and I think there's so much to say.
Sure.
So, I hadn't expected my body to wake up as part of this process, and stumbling into this result was astonishing. What I was discovering was the incredible power of self-regulation. This choosing power had been lost in the throes of addiction. The benefits of my awakeness practice have been far-reaching. When I inhabit my body, I can self-regulate. I can also know when things like behaviors, relationships, and thought patterns are toxic, neutral, or nourishing. I have only to tune into myself to know. And from there, I must go on to the next, even more challenging step. That of tolerance. So Justin, I want to just quickly say that when I read this source, so maybe people might not realize this, but what happens is that on Fridays, Justin and I post a source each and we do it alternate weeks. So we take turns and each of us doesn't know what the other one is going to post or what it's going to be. And so there is these times when just so often Justin's source just totally kind of floors me. And this in some ways was one of them, because I think this is such a brave topic to choose to speak about. And it's so big. And so I really appreciate, Justin, that you've chosen this. And I feel myself, and there's a vulnerability in speaking about this. There really is. And I really appreciate the way that you've linked it to the bigger kind of narratives and systemic cultural things that relate to this as well. Like, it's not just an individual thing to be dealing with addiction, but that addiction is also supported and fueled by the systemic principles that we are a part of and subject to. And I really appreciate your introduction into that as well, because I noticed that I can very easily go into a very personal story about this. And of course, that's relevant and welcome. But what I appreciate is this invitation to also see that it's not just on my shoulders that this happens to me, that I don't feel like I have choice and that I have addiction in me, but that there's also a load of stuff that we are taught so much of the time into addictive behaviors, into falling asleep, into being dissociated from our own capacity to self-nourish. And so I'm really appreciating the source and how wide a topic this is and how brilliant it is that you chose it.
I'm so with you, Lizzie, about this point about this isn't only about us as separate individuals. And that's very much behind my wanting to bring the source this week, is that first of all, I've been looking again and again and again, and I keep on finding out how easy it is for me to tune out and to go to sleep. It's super easy. And to go far from my own experience and to want to not have whatever experience I'm having. So it's the primary route for me, I think, is start to have an experience that I don't really want to have, and then follow the paths that are available to us in our culture to get away from myself.
Yes.
All the ways in which I go to sleep. So food, you know, mindlessly eating, of course, is one. There's any number of them. And that's why I brought in buying to start with, because one of the reasons I think this is so important, one of the reasons I think we have such trouble with addiction in our culture, and I mean from small to big. I mean the small everyday acts of tuning out from ourselves and feeding ourselves in a not nourishing way with something that just happens to be nearby or impulsively, and the big kinds of addictions that can swallow up a whole life. We're swimming in a sea of culture which encourages this, even at the same time as it says it's a terrible problem. And we are maybe 60 years, maybe a bit longer, into the deliberate manufacturing of a culture that would do this. And the whole move of don't trust yourself, maybe even prior, don't really feel what you're feeling, just smother it with something that we have to sell you. None of us have managed to escape that, I suspect. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so grateful. I think with the way Christine Caldwell writes about it, it's so brilliant. And the book is really extraordinary as well, because she's pointing right into something that's very true, which is that we have enormous capacity to tell what nourishes us. And particularly if what she writes here doesn't get into this part of it, so I want to bring it in, particularly if we will find ourselves good relational support for ourselves so that we can talk to people about it and we're not just trying to do it on our own. Our bodies really can tell a lot. Not always, not infallibly. Sometimes we make poor choices for ourselves, but there's a lot we can tell about what's life-giving for us. And you know, one of the things I know about myself, Lizzie, is that sometimes part of what makes this much worse is I'm afraid of my own capacity to know. Like the sort of the not trusting that I can tell, and that very easily, when those moments, keeps me in a kind of, it's a bit like being an infant, sort of infantile state where I'll rely on, not on myself, not on my body, but I'll rely on the things that are in the fridge or the stuff that's on TV or just zoning out, which nobody can sell me something when I'm zoning out, but it's the same move.
Yeah, I think it's really, I think I've said before so many times, it feels like I have anyway, about this, the shame that we have around all of these things as well. So all the ways that this stuff stays secret, all of our avoidance tactics that feel really shameful and difficult to speak about and difficult to admit, I feel like it's such an important role that any of us has in life to be honest and to say these things and to do that. So far in the communities that we make, doesn't seem to alienate us, it seems to endear us, and yet we still find it so hard to say, yeah, I stick on the television when I don't know what to do with myself, or I stand in front of the fridge and stare at it for ages thinking that whatever's in it is going to fix whatever the problem is that I'm feeling that I have right now, or that if I eat some ice cream I'm not going to feel this way or something. I think we all have these things. And So one of the things that I do, so one of my kind of shameful admissions, is that I think when I'm feeling really lost, I just think of something that I think that I need. And then I go on Amazon and I scroll through Amazon to see if it's got the thing that I think that is going to fill the need that I have. And it's really tricky territory. And so Christine only mentions the word addiction once in this passage, and I know that her book is beautifully intimate and deep in this topic, but I think addiction is such a huge thing that's going on all the time, and there's a kind of shameful relationship to addiction in our society. It's like, oh gosh, they're an addict or something, and actually I really think that I don't think I've met many people who aren't addicts. I include myself in that bracket, and I may not have such an extreme expression of it, but the extremity of the expression isn't really the point. It, the origins are the same for me and you as whoever else that we could imagine that we might have labeled as being addicted to something or having an addiction thing going on. And this flight from self, this not being able to tolerate what's here or feeling like I need to get away from something, is really, I think, a very universal human thing. And so what one of the books that popped up in my mind as I was reading this was Russell Brand's recovery book, which I think is the most brilliant, compassionate, brilliantly accessible thing that I've encountered on addiction. And what I love about it is that it's aligned with what you and I are standing for here, Justin, which is that to be together in these things, to be disclosive about these things, and to find community where this information about one another is welcomed and encouraged rather than marginalized and shamed. And the more we bring the shameful stuff to each other and to the light, the more I think those systemic things that you're talking about get to be seen in the light, rather than stay the very, very powerful things that determine the way we act, the way we think about ourselves, how we define. Something. And the way that we could be a community could be a way of becoming transparent to those things, or those things becoming transparent to us, rather than them having us blindly. And so I just feel really strongly about being an advocate for this awakening, because in the awakening between us and de-shaming all the stuff that we think we can't bring, we get to see clearly, and we get to then acknowledge how these things have a hold over us, and then they don't have to have a hold over us anymore because we've seen through them. So I just don't think it's separate. I think every conversation that we have with one another is a part of depowering the things that have power over us, so that we can hold them in our hands and make decisions as human beings, which is our birthright, to be intentional, decision-making, choiceful beings that see things for what they are, rather than be held by them, pulled around unconsciously by them, ruled by them. And it starts with the conversations. It starts with you and I in relationship with one another, continually bringing to the light the things that we don't think we can bring to the light, so we can really see through all of the things that bind us to something that's actually not ours, but it's made of someone else's choice, someone else's decisions about what a life should look like, yeah, or how we should be behaving, or what we should do with our money or our bodies, our health, all of it.
That's so beautifully said, Lizzie. And I found myself holding on closely to your saying our birthright is to be intelligent, choiceful. You said something else, purposeful beings, like we can feel things, think things, mean things, care about things, and make decisions for ourselves. And part of the what I'm seeing as you're speaking is that part of the difficulty with all of these addictions, and I want to keep on saying that we're including here, I'm certainly including eating mindlessly from the fridge, binging on streaming TV. For me, tuning out whilst reading my emails, like going to email and using it as a way to tune out, that all of those ways in which we abandon ourselves, then get, what makes it difficult for us is that we get ashamed about them. Like I was thinking whilst you were speaking, the part of the trap for me is I when I fall into behaving in one of those ways, it feels like I have no choice, which first of all isn't true, and then second of all is I get ashamed that I even did this in the first place, because like Christine Caldwell says, I don't feel nourished. When I go and turn on the email, I don't have social media on any of my devices at the moment, even though we're doing this on Facebook. But email is the one that's been the big trap for me. I turn it on. It feels so obvious that that's what I should do. I very, very quickly feel not at all nourished by it. And then I'm ashamed that that's how I feel. And then very often what I do is hide away the shame and then keep going with it, which is exactly the thing that keeps the pattern going. It's our shame that we ought to be more onto ourselves, and the feeling that this is somehow at odds with ourselves, that keeps us in the very difficulty. And I love what you're saying, and I think it's so true that when we find a way of being honest about ourselves, with ourselves and with one another, and then we find out that we're all in this together, is the place where the trance has a chance of being lifted. And we can start to see ourselves and one another clearly again, which is, oh, we're all in this. We're all being had by this. We don't, most of us live in a culture which teaches us, where we've learned how to be present and in contact with ourselves and our lives and each other. And even, I was thinking whilst you were speaking, even this amazing practice of mindfulness that comes from so many different paths and traditions over the history of the world has itself become another commodity which we can use to tune out. You know, so anything, so mindfulness as a way of talking about what it is to be awake and in contact and present to our lives, and so that we can exercise whatever ability to choose it is that we have, which is such a wonderful thing, of course, is available to us in lots of ways and has also been turned into a commodity that you can, you know, you can zone out using an app on your phone, which isn't at all what we're talking about. So seeing that, And I want to just come back to economics for a moment, because it seems to me that part of what makes this so powerful is that there's so much money to be made in people tuning out. And that's part of, it's not that making money from things is a bad thing. It's a wonderful thing that people should have money and should be able to eat and feed themselves and, you know, have choices and all of that. That's not what I'm talking about. It's that we all inescapably live in a culture that will very easily have us go back to sleep because there are so many opportunities in it. And that's why I think naming it in the way that you're talking about is so important. And also can feel so threatening. Because if we start to talk about the ways in which we're in the midst of the shame of addictive going to sleep patterns in our lives, we might, to a certain measure, break the trance, and then we'd stand out, right? We wouldn't just be doing what everybody else is doing.
Exactly, and it's like, it's one thing to say, awake, awaken. And then, you know, I think as Christine alludes to at the end of that reading as well, then what is it to tolerate what's on offer in the unknown of non-habitual practice? Like, how do we then live into and in the moment of the unsupported by addiction state? And how do we be in that place of not knowing what to do, how to be, because we haven't got the crutch that we were using before? And maybe we don't yet have the faith that what's beyond that, what's beyond the crutches, what's beyond the thing that I feel has been holding me up, if we don't have the faith that there's something there, it really is terrifying. And so I don't know how to do that without support, without someone being with me, without there being contact. I think contactfulness in the unknown is what helps us to be in the unknown. And to have a language for it, like we're languaging now, where we can articulate what the unknown might be, or that there is an unknown, is really, really helpful and allows at least some access to being with it and for there being progress. And I think that's what's really meaningful to me, is the kind of community that we can create around and for one another and ourselves that allows us to be held in the unknown and to live in the beyond, rather than having to keep going back and going back and going back, even though we will go back and go back and go back because it is terrifying. How do we be in the conversation about the difference between the unknown versus the habitually supported state? And keep talking about it and stay in relationship about it, about just that. And I think that's what this whole deal is, what Turning Towards Life is, what our relationship is for, how we are with one another, what our community is, why we do coaching. You know, I think that's really the crux of it.
I think so too. And we have reached already that time. Yeah, it's 9:32. So although there's so much more to say on this, I think we should probably end here and come back for episode 49 of Turning Towards Life in a Week.
I can't believe it. It's amazing. Well, I really, really feel inspired by this conversation, really enjoyed being in the unknown of it, actually. I think that's what this also, the conversation brings to me, is the capacity to be in touch with that unknownness. And I'm really grateful and very glad to be wondering about what source I might choose next week as well.
Thank you, Lizzie. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you next week.